Well, if you're new here today, we're going to start crossing bridges as we conclude our time that you may be wondering, how can you say that? Where's that coming from? We're sort of building sequentially over the last 3 weeks, but basically the macro view is all of us by default operate as abandoned orphans. Even if we've had good parents, we feel a need to prove ourselves. We feel a need to justify ourselves. We feel like we're alone. All of us, by default, are abandoned orphans. And when you get adopted through Jesus into the family of God, there's all kind of verses in the Bible that talk about this, you become a treasure child. All of us are in one of these two camps. We're primarily looking at, why is it that many people who are treasured children, who are valued by God, who are in a relationship with Jesus, still feel and operate as an abandoned orphan, as if they're all alone, as if everything depends on their performance? And so three big temptations that Jesus wrestled with, three, if you will, counter identities to being a treasured child are being looked at. The first one, we looked at appetite. That oftentimes we are driven to consume food, or we have an appetite for alcohol, or an appetite for working out, or an appetite for promotions, or an appetite for adventure, because there's an inner longing inside of us, a longing to have, because we don't feel exactly right. Next week we looked at approval, that we are so often saying things in order for people to like us, doing things for people to approve of us, and wanting to justify our existence and the people like us because we're not sure that God actually approves of us. And so we're also trying to help us understand that there's nothing wrong with appetite. God's blessed us with taste buds. Wonderful. Taste beautiful things. He's given us the ability to have pleasures. Wonderful. Nothing wrong with appetite, but if we're using our appetites to numb us out to deeper realities, there's something wrong here. And there's nothing wrong with approval. I like people liking me. Do you? I hope you do. In fact, if you don't like it when people like you, no one likes you. You are annoying. You're annoying. You are selfish. No one like, you know, if you don't care what people like you or not, that you're not a person I want to be around. There's nothing wrong with being approved of. It's just that we should want God's approval more than people's approval. And when we feel approval by God, we'll interact with other people in a healthy and better way. And today, the third big one we're looking at is ambition. Ambition. Boy, I'm getting a little cold in here. Gosh, I don't know if they turned the AC up or, you know, what's going on in here? Some of you are going, people here for the first time are going, what's the big deal? Well, I don't understand. Well, if you've been around for any length of time, you've never really seen me in these threads. This is a bit different for me. I normally don't choose clothes like this to wear, and the reason is the clothes I choose, my fashion is, I like clothes that don't itch. That's how I choose clothes. Doesn't itch, I think I will wear it. That's what I do. And today, I'm going to sort of stay in character. I've been wearing the last few weeks orphan duds, looking like Oliver Twist, trying to remind ourselves and remind myself, all of us, of what an abandoned orphan is like. And today I'm going to the other side of the spectrum. I'm not saying that if you dress like this, you are a treasured child. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that even abandoned orphans can look like this. You can be incredibly successful. You can be dressed for success. You can be all fly and at the same time be very abandoned. Feel like you're trying to prove yourselves. There are treasured children who have the means to dress the way I've dressed the last couple of weeks, but yet you are treasured. And there are also people who have the ability to dress this way and yet are incredibly orphan-like. For many of us, our ambition, our drive to succeed, whether it represents itself in clothes or degrees or businesses started or hobbies we've gotten better at or family that's gotten more healthy, we have any number of different realms that our ambition will manifest itself in order to make ourselves feel that we are good versus God telling us that we are good. And I am not anti-ambition. I am pro-ambition. In fact, some of us in here, you need to get some freaking motivation in your life. You just do. I mean, the Bible talks about one of the seven deadly, not the Bible, the ancient church would talk about seven deadly sins, one of them being sloth. Some of us are way too unmotivated, way too undisciplined, got real issues. So I'm not against ambition, but what I am against and what God is against is using our accomplishments to satisfy the inner need we have to feel like we're important. Chris Mullin said this, if your ambition is to leave a legacy, it wasn't Chris Mullin, I'm sorry, it was Rich Mullins. Rich Mullinson says, I always get them mixed up, if your ambition is to leave a legacy, your legacy will be ambition. A Christian recording artist who's now dead. If your ambition is to leave a legacy, your legacy will be ambition. You know, if you want to make your mark on the world, you want to be known by what you have done, guess what? You will be known by somebody who had drive, not necessarily somebody who's motivated by love and an amazing identity as a treasured child of God. Jesus receives his identity, or he has publicly affirmed, personally validated his identity, when in Matthew chapter 3 and other times in the Bible this is recorded, it says this, and behold, a voice from heaven said, this is my beloved Son, with whom I am well pleased. He is validated. He is given the identity and affirmed as an actual treasured child. And from there, he goes into the wilderness for 40 days, having everything stripped away from him. Everything. He fasts for 40 days. He has all means of appetite gone. He can't take any adventures. He can't eat food. He's not having any alcohol. All of that is stripped from him, and he has to wrestle with whether or not he's secure and confident to be affirmed as a treasured child of God, as the Son of God. Then last week, approval. Not only was he away and away from food, but he was away from human affirmation. He could get no human affirmation, no human approval at all. And it was a question whether or not he could still live on the very approval of God. And another thing he has stripped away from him is ambition. And here's what happens in Matthew chapter 4, the third and final temptation. Again, the devil took him to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their glory. And he said to him, all these I'll give you if you will fall down and worship me. Then Jesus said to him, begone, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only shall you serve. Now the Bible teaches that Jesus was God even before he was born in Bethlehem and has existed. And so he has had all of these things, and he will have these things. In fact, the Bible says that as a result of his faithfulness, he gets unique rewards. And Satan, the adversary, the accuser, he's accusing him that, come on, you're the Son of God, come on. You're not a treasured child of God, come on. All right, prove it, validate it right now. And he gives him three ways to validate him. And one way is all this stuff. I take you right now, see all these kingdoms, you can have all of them. All of them, your drive, your ambition, you can have all of these, right? Anything that your ambition or drive would reward you with, I'm going to reward you right now. He's actually giving him a shortcut. He's going to get all these things anyway, but he's giving him a shortcut. And how does he get the shortcut? By bowing down to the evil one, by making him his master, by having him define his life instead of his heavenly Father defining his life. You know, Jesus, I believe he was an ambitious guy. I believe he was a driven guy. From age 30 when he comes out at age 30 as the Son of God until he dies at age 33. In those 3 years, he gets more done than any human that's ever walked the planet. There's not a single religion. There's not a single spirituality. There's not a single life coach. There's not a single self-help speaker that in some way, shape, or form doesn't draw into what the teachings Jesus did. And it isn't just because he's got the divine working in him as God. It's because the guy had drive. He had passion. And he has that stripped away for 40 days. He can't accomplish anything. He can't improve his carpentry skills. He can't do anything. It's stripped away. You really know what's important to you if you can live without it for 40 days. That's why many of us had a lot of learning that very first week when we went on a fast for a week of something or a portion of that week. We learned things about ourselves. It was a powerful thing. And some of us, we didn't do that at all. And it may have very well have been because we felt like we could not live without that. When you are secure in the identity of God, you can live without anything, but you need to know that the Father approves of us. And this is a core issue. I got an email this last week from a woman. She says this. You were orphaned, Brian, as an infant. Bill, was her husband, was orphaned as an adult. He had been disowned by his parents for a long time, and finally he got it at his dad's funeral. As the world sees him, he is bright, successful, and connected, but consumed by drive to perform. This gets in the way of us as a couple, and it has become our normal. How can couples or friends support one another in this matter? I don't want this series to go into the food for thought slot with the disconnect happening when a new series begins. This, to me, is core stuff. This is core stuff. It's why this happens at the very beginning of Jesus' ministry. It is core stuff, and it's why we're going to be looking deeper in this in our next all-church journey in the fall. This is actually a taste test of what we're going to deal with in an intense way for 6 weeks next fall. We're going to have take-home things for you to deal with, things to wrestle with God, small group material. So I just want you to know, if this resonates with you, get ready, because we're going to really build into you and any friends you have as well coming up in a few months. It's going to be really good stuff. This one for me, this ambition, is one I personally own the most. I have elements of all three that play on me, but this one is sort of my core one, ambition. If you show me or have a family time and I look at pictures of my kids and my family from, you know, 10, 15 years ago, as my kids will tell you, dad starts getting all misty-eyed and I start getting a bit emotional. And why is that? It's not just because I love my family, though I do love my family. It's because when I see my family pictures from 15 years ago, which is about when Crossroads started, I think of the lost opportunity. I think of the ways that I would love to go back and experience certain moments with my kids, but I'll never get to do it again because I came to Cincinnati, man on mission. I was ready to make my mark. I felt like I was prepared, and away I went. I had this drive and this ambition that actually went beyond God validating me and this propelling me to do stuff. It actually went to sort of proving myself in a need to validate myself through my ambition, through my accomplishments. And had I could have worked a significant percentage less, and still had the same results, but I couldn't do that. I couldn't do that because every day was pass, fail, and I had to get things done. And I regret lost opportunities, and not only that, I regret the condition of my heart and many of my decisions that took place back then. Ambition is a driver for me. Now, I'm happy to say that right now, it's not my main driver. I am still ambitious. I am still driven. I have ambition to see in Cincinnati that there's no foster care problem. I am ambitious and driven to help anybody at Crossroads get help so that we could wipe out the foster care problem. And we could do that, you know. We have enough people here that if you felt a nudging for that, that would be done. That's an ambition and a drive I have. I have an ambition and a drive that nobody who lives within the Cincinnati region would not hear about things like this in this series in language they could understand, in the humor that they laugh to. I have a passion, I have a drive for that. I will never be satisfied with just this many people knowing about Jesus or seeking. Never, never. When is Crossroads big enough? When every single person in Cincinnati knows who Jesus, that's when it is. Every single person. Now, this is really weird. The 3 weeks in a row, I've said things 11:45 I haven't said any other week, and then I'm going to go back and repeat it all. I'll have to say it next week for every other service. I don't know what that is. You guys got a real run going here for your 11:45. You're like stoking me or something like that. So, but that's different from an ambition to justify myself as an abandoned orphan, to prove to other people that I could do it, to have my accomplishments mean something. So I know this one. Let me tell you, when you're fueled by ambition, number one, there is a relaxation and celebration deficit. You have a relaxation celebration deficit. You don't chillax, ever. Taking time off, it just doesn't happen. Every year, you leave vacation days on the table. You don't take one day out of seven at minimum to be unproductive, what's called a Sabbath. Even your vacations have got to be exercises in productivity. You can't go more than 3 hours without checking email, checking voicemail. You're going away on vacation in order to strategically plan, in order to clear your head. You feel a need to come back from breaks, letting people know some big aha that you've had or whatever. No. What's wrong with doing nothing? What's wrong with having a couple extra beers for no purpose at all? But when you are about ambition, everything has to have a point, and you go, go, go. That's why God was so intense about taking one day out of seven at a minimum and relaxing. It's It's called the Sabbath. It's in his top 10 list called the Ten Commandments. And he told the nation of Israel, he said, if you don't do this, I should kill you. Why is that? It's because when you and I can't disconnect from our ambitions, can't disconnect from our productivity, what we're basically saying to God is, God, you can't handle my life. The accounts won't get handled unless I do it. You are devaluing the presence of a creator who is in control because you are in control. You are the one who has to make hay every single day. When you're in this state, you probably don't have a healthy sense of play. There's probably not a healthy outlet that you can do that simply blows off time. See, ambition isn't bad. It's just that the ambition that supersedes our identity as treasured children, or the ambition that validates our identity as treasured children, is the thing that's bad. Now, second thing that happens when you're fueled by ambition versus your identity as a treasured child is you never have or do enough. You never have or do enough. Now, if your ambition, all of us, by the way, have a scorecard. Everyone has a scorecard that tells you how you're doing. Some of us have a scorecard that money, our account tells us how we're doing. Some of us have a scorecard that is, you know, my physical appearance tells me how I'm doing, or my family. But when you're ambitious, whatever it is never enough, ever. You always need more. If it's money, you never have enough, just a bit more. If it's higher learning, you never have enough degrees. You've never read enough books. If it is, you know, physical fitness, you never have a low enough body fat. If it is your family is never healthy enough. You never have enough kids. You've never had enough good conversations. It's just never enough. I interacted with a guy I know who, in his business, in his category, no question, in Cincinnati, he is number one in that category. Number one. And you'd know the business if I told you what it was. And I interacted with him a while ago, and his business has been hit because of the housing crisis, and people aren't building as much stuff and as they used to. And so for the first time since he started that business, for the first time, the business hasn't grown. For the first time, he hasn't grown for a couple years at a minimum of 10%. And I said, how does that make you feel? He said, I feel like poop. Didn't know exactly what he said, but I feel like a piece of poop is what he said. Why is that? Because even though he's still the best, even though he's still number one, his ambition of constant growth, constant improvement, when he can't hit that for factors that are beyond his control, he doesn't feel like he measures it, never have enough. This was brought home really clearly to me through an amazing book, fascinating book, Steve Jobs' biography. I almost say Steve Jobs' autobiography because it's as accurate. It's actually more accurate than an autobiography could be. Fascinating book. He actually recruited somebody to write a book on him, Walter Isaacson. He read Walter Isaacson's books on Ben Franklin and Albert Einstein, and he said, I want that guy to write a book about me. So for years, he recruited Walter Isaacson to write a biography on him, and Walter Isaacson kept saying, no, 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 no. Finally, he decided to do it. He had 40 personal interviews with Steve Jobs. He had unfettered access to all of Steve Jobs' inner core and all of the core around him. He was at his deathbed. So this isn't some Kitty Kelly kiss and tell all biography. This is based on real research. And part of the reason why many of us were rocked by Steve Jobs' death is because, though we never knew the man, he was the only male authority figure that ever blessed us. Every time you use an iPhone or an iPad and it works, you think, oh, Steve Jobs is awesome. He's just awesome. And honestly, for a lot of us, he's the only male authority figure that's actually blessed you and has never hurt you. That's another series. But here's the fascinating thing about, actually it's not, it's this series. I just can't blow that out more than I did. But if you want to understand a bit about him, read this book. It's a fascinating book. I love on the leadership level, we see how as a leader, he was great because he would have macro vision, like we need to reformat the music industry in terms of delivery of content, macro vision, and yet he was in the micro details. Many leaders want to just be about the vision thing up there. No, it can't be. You can't be about that. It's also going to be about the micro details. He not only was reformatting the delivery of content musically, but he at the same time was anal about the heads of the screws on the inside of the iMac that no one would ever see. That's how involved in the detail he was. And to understand how he was as ambitious as he was, Isaacson nails it. His very first chapter, he talks about he who is abandoned abandons others. And here's what he says in the first chapter. Jobs confided to close friends that he was driven by the pain he was feeling about being put up for adoption and not knowing about his birth parents. So his adoption isn't what jacked him. What had jacked him was he felt abandoned. And you can have great parents, as we talked about, but still feel abandoned and that you are alone. And so his whole life was about succeeding, ambitious, making people pay for not taking him seriously, climbing the ladder, justifying his existence. It comes through over and over and over and over again. And it wasn't a need for more money. Part of why people liked Steve Jobs is he didn't seem to make as much as other CEOs. He wore the same clothes all the time. He wasn't driven by money like a Larry Ellison of Oracle or maybe a Bill Gates was, who was driven by something else. Here's what Isaacson says. He had neither Ellison's conspicuous consumption needs nor Gates' philanthropic impulses, nor the competitive urge to see how high in the Forbes list he could get. Instead, his ego needs and personal drives led him to seek fulfillment by creating a legacy that would awe people. A dual legacy, actually, building innovative products and building a lasting company. He wanted to be in the pantheon of other tech business leaders. When you're ambitious, whatever the sector you want to be ambitious in, it will never be enough. Not only that, number three, past hurts are motivation. For ambitious, and by the way, I'm giving you six of them. You may have this as a dominant driver. One of you might say, but nonetheless, these are generally true of those of us who wrestle with ambition. Past hurts are fuel for motivation. We think about those things, those discrepancies, those hurts. We chew on those bitter roots like they're vegetables that are going to nourish us for another mile. We chew on them and chew on them and chew on them. If you've used an iPhone or an iPad, and you ever go into a website and there's a certain video you can't play, it's because it's in Adobe, and Steve Jobs was driven to stuff it in Adobe's face for not doing something that was hurtful to him years and years before. It's why you still can't play many Adobe things on Apples and iPads. It was this motivation he had to beat somebody to make them pay. Same with Michael Jordan. Greatest basketball player of all time, was driven by ambition and chewed on every piece of bitterness he could to motivate him to go to next levels. Have you ever seen his Hall of Fame acceptance speech? He just categorized. He actually thanked everybody who had done him wrong in his life. Weird, really weird. One of the things you probably heard about Michael Jordan is that he was cut from his high school basketball team and this propelled him to get better. His high school coach finally spoke up this last year. He's never actually talked about it. He actually set the record straight. He said, Mike Jordan was a ninth grader. There were 12 guys better than him, and I put him on the JV team. He wasn't cut the way we hear it. Oh, he was, no. When you're a ninth grader, you play JV. But yet he had to think this in his mind as some personal front and use it for fuel. How about you? You still remember what somebody said to you a long time ago? You still remember the promotion you didn't get and think through, boy, I bet your boss wished it made a different decision now. Past hurts drive us. Number four, it's hard to take counsel and give credit. When you're ambitious, it needs to depend on you. Now, if you're ambitious and really smart, what you realize, it's easy to give credit because you get to a place where you realize, if everyone's working for me, I can get ambitious and get ahead more. So sometimes you might be conniving by sharing credit so people are more motivated so you can drive them higher. But most of the time, abandoned orphans are just doing what's instinctual and just realize, gosh, if I share credit, make people feel good, they'll work harder for me so I can get further. But it's also very difficult for ambitious people to receive ideas that they didn't generate on their own. Why is that? It's because if you give me an idea that wasn't my own and I do it and it actually works, I didn't do it. It's not about the goal. It's about who gets the drive, who gets the apple. So it's very difficult. But for you, can you identify an idea or a thought that you never had and maybe you disagreed with that you actually did? Very few of us do that. Very few. Especially those who are ambitious. Number five, failures are devastating. Devastating. Because when we fail, we did it on our own and we failed on our own. It's hard to blame anybody else. We have yet again come up short. Someone told us we were going to come up short, and so now we're driven to show them differently, and now it seems like they're right, and we are devastated. It's hard to find things to learn and failures, because failures are tied to our identity, because our performance, our drive is what verifies our existence, verifies our goodness, verifies our smarts. And when it doesn't work out, we're devastated. That's why the financial market's crashing for some people was devastating. It wasn't that you didn't have any money. You still have money, but it was devastating because you're going, I should have saw that coming. Why did I not do that? Why didn't I put everything in bonds? Oh, gosh, I thought I was. It's devastating because that's a sign of your ambition. Sixth and final one I'll share with you is personal sin is personally handled. So when I do something that's wrong, I can't receive forgiveness from God. I can say I'm forgiven from God, but I got to work on it. Like, truth be told, some of us are here today because of what we did last night. And part of that's healthy. I need to go someplace and get regrounded. That part of that's healthy. But part of it is sort of a cycle that some of us have of, I did something wrong, now I have to do something good. I have to sort of weigh out the scales or do this sort of penance with God. Ambitious people have a real hard time accepting the love and the grace of God. Here's what that love and grace looks like. It means that anything that I've done wrong, Jesus paid for that and I don't have to pay. In fact, it also means that anything Jesus did good, I get credit for that. I get credit for anything that he did that is good. Amazing. This is called the substitutionary atonement of Christ. As he's on a cross, all of my rebelliousness, orphan characteristics, sinfulness is actually placed on, there's a wire transfer of all my discrepancies, all my, it's wire transferred to the back of Jesus. And when I receive Jesus into my heart, when I receive him, there's a wire transfer of his righteousness that comes over to me. So when God looks at me, he doesn't see Brian who has problems, though he knows I do. He actually looks at me, sees my heart, sees the presence of his son, and says, there is the Holy One. I get Christ's righteousness. Now, this is why in our society there is an ever-growing acceptance and belief in reincarnation. And if you want to believe in reincarnation, fine. You know, we all get to believe whatever we want to believe. I just would say this. You cannot fit reincarnation into Jesus. Reincarnation and Jesus are utterly opposed, utterly opposite. See, because Jesus was so successful and effective, every religion, spirituality that's represented in America and across the world wants to co-opt him in somehow. So whatever the American brand of Buddhism, the American brand of Hinduism, the American brand of humanism, of existentialism, we all want to tap into Jesus because the dude just did his deal in 3 years. He was the greatest. He just was the greatest. So we want to cop him in. And it really bothers me. You can believe anything you want, but it just bothers me when you take a system that is totally opposed to Jesus and try to think it validated. Here's what reincarnation is. Reincarnation is a great way for spiritually ambitious people to get ahead. Because what does it mean? It means I will get rewarded for everything I do in this life, and I can rectify my difficulties. So I can improve myself spiritually, and I can come back the next life as a wonderful, beautiful millionaire who doesn't have any addictions. Or I can do all these awful things and now I've got to work it off the next life. I come back as a politician. I come back as somebody who is, or a mole or something like that. I just come back in a really different, see, that's what reincarnation is. It depends on you and your spiritual ambition, how well you do it. And the way of Jesus is not like that at all. In fact, it says in the book of 2 Corinthians chapter 5, it says this, therefore, if anyone is in Christ, he's a new creation. The old is gone, the new has come. Not the old is going away, not your old identity is ebbing away. No, God says, no, you're not that person. You are a new person. God made him who had no sin to be sin for us. He who had no sin took my sin on. That's why Jesus, when he's on the cross, one of the last things he said as he's dying is, it is finished. Meaning you need not be spiritually ambitious and pay off your own sin any longer. It is finished. And that's why Buddha, his last words were, never cease striving. And ambitious people understand this. We're treasured children say, I don't fully understand it. My goodness, but that I've got a dad who's got my back and it actually gives me things that I couldn't do for myself. Crazy. See, again, ambition isn't bad. It's only bad when it supersedes our identity or it's a false identity. But ambition, that flows from our identity as a treasured child is amazing. Here's the deal. Some of us in here may have a paid-off mortgage. I've never had a paid-off. Any time I've ever lived, I've always had rent or mortgage. Someday maybe I'll have this. Someday I'll be out of debt, hopefully that way. But just imagine all of us who have a mortgage, that you get a letter tomorrow and it says, "Dear Mr. and Mrs. So-and-so, the bank has decided for various reasons, new regulations or whatever reason, they send you a letter saying your debt is forgiven. Your debt is forgiven." And actually they send you your deed in the mail. I assume there's a deed they send you. I've never had one, so I assume that happens. So the deed to your house is there. You own it free and clear. They have forgiven the debt. Now, here's the question. How much do you owe Fifth Third? How much do you owe PNC when that happens? Nothing. I even told you this last week, 11:45. I told you this last week, and I repeat this for every single service this entire weekend, and still, second week in a row, you're going, "How much?" Now, I know this is a trick question. No, you owe the bank nothing. That's what forgiveness is. You owe the bank nothing. So, as a treasured child, what you owe God when you receive His forgiveness is nothing. You owe Him nothing. He's not looking for you to give back. He's not looking for you to justify. He's not looking for you to even the scales. You owe God nothing. Nothing. Now, and when a treasured child gets this, it doesn't make them go, "Woo-hoo, partay, woo." No, a treasured child, that propels them then to say, "Oh, I can't wait to serve under my King. I can't wait." So it doesn't mean our life gets worse. It just means our base motivation is different. We don't operate out of any sense of obligation at all because we are forgiven. We're debt-free. Now, so oftentimes the physical realm models and communicates the spirit realm, and this is the way it is with orphanhood and with adoptions, and I want to invite a friend of mine up to talk about his personal experience. Please welcome Justin Wolfenberg. Justin.
Yes.
Man, you're looking so slovenly. Yes. How can you possibly dress like that?
You're setting a high standard
this
week.
Yes, I know.
Man.
Go ahead.
So my wife and I had our first kid and then quickly found out afterwards, after our first son was born, that we were unable to have more children, and he was a miracle kid. And so we said, what's next for us? And we decided to sign up for an adoption in China. And we said, could we adopt a girl who was born with a cleft lip and cleft palate? Because when I was born with a cleft lip and cleft palate. And we were matched up with Layla. And on our way over to China, I was really wondering, can I just love a kid that just handed over to me that in a moment's notice? And when we were walking into the room we were going to meet her, we actually got on the elevator, and I saw her for the first time. And my heart, like, just skipped a beat. And something happened inside of me, and I felt something intense. And I remember, like, a tear coming down my cheek. I don't cry. And I fell in love with her, boom, right then and there, hardcore. But her, this was overwhelming to her. She fell in my wife's arms and just collapsed. I mean, she was abandoned in a park. She had to share a crib with someone. She was on tainted milk. She was malnourished. She didn't even show up on growth charts for months. And so for the first 3 weeks of her life, she completely rejected me. If I got near her, she just screamed. And around week 4 or 5, she started to kind of soften toward me and started to let me be her father a little bit. And then it was time for surgery at Children's. And the surgery was 4.5 hours long, and we were pretty excited because we knew at this point she could start talking, she could start eating solid foods. There were some good things that were going to happen. This was a good thing for her. And on our way back to the recovery room, I'm thinking she's going to be laid out on the bed. When we got back there, she was screaming, like rage screaming, and they were giving her morphine. The nurse couldn't even hold her. She screamed for 6 hours straight, and they were... Finally, the nurse said, "You know, Justin, she's not in pain. She's just angry." And I said, "Oh, okay, that changes the game. I can do that." I hold her. She's just pounding my chest. I said, "I'll take it. I will take it as your father." That's what I had to do to God. I had to pound my fist at God, and God just wrapped His arm around me. And I look back at that time with Layla, my daughter, some of the most precious, intimate, special times I have ever had. And I bonded to her faster than I have any of my other kids. And man, she's a beautiful 4-year-old today. Just looking wonderful, man. Yeah. Awesome. And so now she has a place at our table with our family. And my wife and I said, I think there's actually might be another seat at the table. So we signed up to do this foster care thing with that we've been talking around here. We did the paperwork, the training. We were ready to go. And we get this call. And they said, there's an eight-week-old boy who is born addicted to multiple substances who's not doing well. Will you take him? You've got 10 minutes to decide. I said, what? Overwhelmed. I said, Shelly, this is what we signed up for. Let's go. Let's go. So 45 minutes later, the caseworker comes over, drops the car seat with the baby and says, sign this piece of paper. I got to go. And I said, sit down. We need to talk. I don't know what I'm doing here, you know. And got the information we needed, you know. And we were just holding him. 8 weeks old, I would wave my hand across his face and he wouldn't even blink. He was like just coma, almost coma. He just was not there. And I would hold him. I said, it's not right. I felt a sadness. A deep sadness in my heart. I said, oh, this is wrong. I'm hurting. I'm hurting for you. And while he had a place at our table for 4 months, he came alive. And our son Henry made him laugh for the first time, man. And we were like, oh, man. Mm-hmm. And today, he's a two-year-old, healthy. He left us. But when he left, a long story, but when he had to move on to his next deal, it tore our heart out because we fell in love with this kid. Mm. And we said, man, that hurts. Does it hurt? Yes. But we, my wife and I said, we will pay the price. Mm. We will love this kid. We will pay the price for this. And my wife said it really well. She goes, it's not enough to say I don't regret that time. She goes, I cherish that opportunity. We have 4 months to line up heartbeat for heartbeat with God. Mm-hmm. And we said, man, there's another open seat at our table. And our friends were doing foster care with us that we met through this community group. And they actually got a kind of a transfer to New Jersey that I don't think they were expecting. And they had a 20-month-old Nini with her. And they said, will you take her? We said, yes, we will take her. We'll let her have a seat at our table. And these kids have been through unfair stuff. And they don't trust. For good reason, they don't trust. I remember we were putting food down for her on her tray, and she would eat it so fast because she didn't trust there would be more food, and to the point she would just throw up. And so we had to feed her at first, piece by piece, until she trusted that there would be food for her at every meal. And when we were playing, I'd be playing and kind of wrestling with the kids in the family room, and she would sit stone-faced, back against the wall, no expression. Watching. I say, come play. No. That was a whole week. Week two, when we were kind of playing around, she moved up to the edge of the carpet. She was leaning in a little bit. Okay. And week three, she ran up, I remember, and she like poked me in the arm and kind of laughed and ran back. And I said, all right, now we're getting somewhere. We're getting somewhere. And week four, she just dove right in, you know, the rest of them been a part of our family. And then her mom made a courageous choice and said, I can't do this mom thing. So we said, yes, you can have a permanent place at our table. And what we have done is when you get a permanent place, you get renamed. Like in the Bible, they went Abram to Abraham and Saul to Paul. So I went home that night at dinner and I said, Nini, you are no longer a Nini. You are now a Naya. And her face was like, poof, big smile, you know. And 2 days later, she goes, Daddy, you tell me my name again. I said, yeah, yes, I will. And to this day, if you mess up her name, she will correct you, you know. She loves her name. And we adopted one more little baby Adria. And this is a picture of our family right here. This is everyone who's got a seat at our table right now, man. And we've been blessed. We've been blessed by this.
Amazing. Now, yeah, he needs to be thanked for that. Now Justin is on the team that's going to be helping anybody who's trying to figure out whether or not adoption, foster care is something you should consider or look into. We're bringing the best of who we are as a Crossroads to help anybody make that decision, and if you do, to be surrounded with support. Justin, for you, I think it's real important for us to hear from you. Why do you do this? Because I know you don't believe that this is some moral thing that anybody who loves God will do. This isn't like some thou shalt not steal, but there's yet you have an ambition about this, a drive. Where does that drive come from?
Yes. When I came here in 1997, I had a hard heart. I was an orphan to the tilt. I remember coming to service here and then walking out to the parking lot and throwing up because I was so hungover. And God, yeah, and then I was ambitious. I worked. I wanted to be the best. And I cared about one person, that was myself. And I didn't need a little Band-Aid. I needed heart surgery. And that heart surgery could only be done, like we were just talking about, by Jesus Christ on the cross, paying a price. And something over a period of time happened inside of me. And I'm different than I was 15 years ago. And I'm thankful. Yes.
So then what you felt spiritually from God, you're doing physically and spiritually for others.
Yes, this was born, this was not me, I'm telling you. If you would ask anyone who knew me 10 years ago, we are in this game because God did something in me, and we have love to give because he gave love to me and my wife.
Justin, thanks for being a blessing all weekend. Amazing. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I have a couple closing words that comes from a chart in form of a charge for us. But before I give those, I want to invite you to stand and be able to respond in song right now. This is a song we've done that's pretty powerful. It tells us and reminds us of the love of God. It's not some far-off, interesting theological concept. It's an ever-present reality, eternal and internal reality right now for treasured children. And many of us are starting to believe it or sense it more and more. So before I give you a final connect the dots, let's have the opportunity to respond right now. So here's the things that were physically true in the Wolfenberg family that are spiritually true of you. First is his daughter, his first daughter. You know, she's got a deformity. She has a deformity. And her daddy identifies with her with that deformity. You and I have a deformity from sin. And Jesus identified with us with that deformity. He became twisted for those who are twisted. He became scarred for those who have scars. He became bruised for those who are bruised. No matter what your difficulty is, Jesus felt it. He's been there. Some of us in here are like that first foster baby that he had, the first foster son. No feeling, no sensation, no awareness of what was happening over them. He said he could kind of take his hands right in front of the eyes, no awareness. There's a sensitization that's happening with many of us in here. You're becoming more sensitive. You're becoming more aware. It's not just because you might be getting older, and the older you get, the more emotional you get. It's because God is doing a healing work on you. You're seeing things that you hadn't seen. You're feeling things you hadn't felt. You're just more aware. And it's wonderful, and it's because your daddy is doing a great work in your life. Then others of us have had this consumption, hoarding, greed problem. And it maybe hasn't just been because we're a bad person. It's what orphans do. We can't share. We've got to, because we can't depend on anybody other than ourselves. But you notice, the more knee, that's not her name, Anaya. I love when he gave the whole name, Anaya Wolfenberg. That's her identity. When she rested in her identity as a treasured child of the Wolfenberg family and in the abundance that was there, she could just take enough. One at a time. She didn't have to hoard, she could release. And God has always been there for you in the midst of your difficulty and our twistedness. Though none of us have the perfect life that we wish we would have had, all of us have things we wish were a bit different, honestly. Can we just say, God has always been there. You're here today because God has made sure that you have just enough. At minimum, you have just enough grace, just enough food, just enough money, and your presence here today shows that. Your daddy has not forgotten you. He is providing for you. How he loves you. He does. All right.